Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science. Science.
Questions. Radio.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
In light of this week's Sony PlayStation hacking reports, today we are presenting an interview with computer scientist Matt Might about cybersecurity. Then Jeff Notkin, co-host of the Science Channel series Meteorite Men, discusses the phenomenon of meteorites. Today he is attending the Endeavour launch party at the Challenger Space Center in Arizona. Endeavour is scheduled to lift off today for a two-week mission in outer space, NASA's final shuttle program mission. This week, Sony announced that a hacker crippled the Sony PlayStation network and obtained personal information, including credit card numbers, billing addresses, and passwords from PlayStation account holders. Sony PlayStation Network has 70 million subscribers who game against each other online. Johnny Minkley, the editor of Eurogamer.net, spoke to CNN this week about the severity of the problem.
This is very, very serious. I think it's very hard to overstate how bad this is at the moment for Sony and potentially for consumers, because in the space of a week we've moved from just not being able to play games via an online service to days where no one's really known what's going on, and finally in a mission last night that personal details have been compromised and potentially credit card details, and it's a very worrying state of affairs, and there's still many, many questions that Sony needs to answer.
It is unclear who is behind the attack, but according to Matt Might, a professor of computer science at the University of Utah, it's one of the most serious, high-profile breaches he has ever seen. And he would know. Might started off as a teenage hacker and is now building an impenetrable computer system, primarily to meet military security needs. But ultimately, his work will provide foolproof software and operating systems to the global community. We asked Might to comment on the PlayStation attack at Sony, and this was his email reply.
What really makes this painful is that much of it results from poor engineering practices on Sony's part. A lot of this could have been prevented or mitigated. It's really embarrassing. The authentication system was apparently quite weak, making it easy to break in. On top of that, there were essentially no internal precautions taken, like encrypting passwords. Storing passwords unencrypted is a basic no-no in secure software construction. That a company of Sony's scale screwed this up is staggering. There also appears to be no isolation between systems, so that once the attacker was in, they got everything all at once.
According to Matt Might, Sony did not take basic precautionary measures to protect their customers. However, this hacking incident is indicative of a much larger cybersecurity problem. We interviewed Matt Might about this issue in March.
We realized that it doesn't matter how much money we want to pay, there is no way we can buy a secure operating system. It doesn't exist. And they saw this as a serious vulnerability, not just for themselves, but for the country as a whole. You know, I think as a first line of defense, we need to get at least our military system secure, because the military is penetrated on a daily basis at this point. They can firewall it, they can patch it, but somebody will still get through. It's just guaranteed. And they realized that, you know, we need a transformative leap in the level of technology we have for security. So I'm part of a project to build secure critical software, which would include a secure operating system. But they're interested in even securing down at the chip level. You know, so starting with securable hardware, moving on to a securable operating system, and then secure applications. And you know, the reason this hasn't been done in the past is that it's very difficult to build provably secure software. And when I say provably secure, I mean provable in the sense of the Pythagorean theorem is true.
The Pythagorean theorem is a mathematical proof that more of us recognize as an equation drilled into us in math class, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And once a theorem such as this is proved, it serves as a solid building block.
And in order to do this kind of thing, you have to reimagine software as a mathematical artifact. And we have the tools to do that, but that means you need mathematicians almost more than you need programmers, because you're going to model this software mathematically and then come in and start proving theorems about it. and saying things like, you know, no matter what kind of input you give to this program, there is no way to get it into a state where somebody can take control of it. These theorems are just very difficult to prove. Even with, you know, massive amounts of aid from computers to help us prove these things, it's still a pretty labor-intensive process. And so our part of this project is to come up with ways to make it feasible for a skilled programmer, maybe not the average programmer yet, to prove theorems about the software they write so that they can make some very strong claims about its security. The nice thing about a theorem is once you've proved it, it's true for eternity. You know, there's nothing you can do to make it untrue. And if that theorem is, this operating system is secure, then that operating system is just secure. And no matter what an attacker wants to do, they can't make it insecure at that point. They will never find a vulnerability. Because what you're doing is in essence, proving that there is no vulnerability in the operating system at all. You know, so first of all, you have to write an operating system with no vulnerabilities. That's tricky because we're pretty bad at doing that. And then you have to prove it. The cost of developing software in that fashion is probably 100 times what it costs to develop ordinary software at the moment.
Mike gives an example of a team in Australia who wrote 7,000 lines of code. A relatively small amount, about as much as an undergraduate student could write in a week, to develop a kernel of operating system software. Might estimates that it costs around $10 million.
To get an idea of how that would scale, keep in mind that an operating system like Windows or Linux or the Mac operating system is probably on the order of millions of lines of code. So, you know, 7,000, scale that up to a million, it's pretty expensive.
And this is the expense of cybersecurity. Computer operating systems and any program has multiple security vulnerabilities, or holes, which can get infected with bugs or viruses, damaging and even overtaking the computer.
Almost every bug presents a problem because it could crash your computer in some way. And then I'd say a majority of the bugs are also security issues because depending on what kind of bug it is, it may allow somebody to take control of the computer. Unfortunately, one of the biggest class of bugs out there is where the computer is not set up to handle the amount of input it's receiving because somebody forgot to do a safety check to see that, can I handle this much input? This is a very common kind of bug. And if they don't include this check, they'll very often will accept too much. And by accepting too much, the attacker can sort of take control of the part of the system where the input overflows. And that's how a lot of these vulnerabilities occur.
Who are we talking about here? Is there sort of a cyber mob out there, or what?
There's a variety of elements out there, and everybody has different purposes. So I'd say, you know, in the U.S., you see a lot of low-level cybercrime, you know, petty theft. People aren't really after, you know, you as an individual per se. You know, they might be after your machine for its resources. And in fact, I'd say that's what the majority of the attackers are after these days, whether in the U.S. or worldwide. What they're trying to do is build up networks of what they call botnets.
Botnets are operating software installations that cyber criminals install on targeted computers. The botnets remain hidden and undetected, spread in a viral fashion.
This is how some of these things can spread worldwide in literally a matter of a half an hour. They can reach every infectable computer. So they're literally after capturing as many computers as they possibly can, on the order of millions. And then they string these things together with a command and control infrastructure and have, you know, literally millions of computers available to do whatever they want. And there's a couple things they can do with that. So people have pointed out that some of these botnets are far larger than our largest supercomputers at this point. So if they wanted to do supercomputing, they certainly could. But that's typically not what they're trying to do. More often, what they'll do is they don't actually want you to know that you're infected, because if you found that you're infected, you're going to go actually get your computer fixed. So a typical infected computer is just going to send out a low level of spam every single day. And so in their normal day-to-day operations, these botnets are just really spam networks, sending out small amounts of spam with each computer, but times a million every day. And if that's the way your computer's been infected, you're probably not going to notice it at all. On the other hand, the other thing they do with these botnets is extortion. And so if you're a small business and one of these, you know, cyber mobs find you, a lot of them are based out of Eastern Europe, they'll come to you and say, you know, either you pay us a certain amount of money, or we will take our botnet and target all of its traffic at you and take you offline. And if this happens, there's really not a whole lot you can do about it. You more or less just have to pay up, unless you're on the level of a Google.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Google has enough bandwidth to absorb all the stuff you can send to it. I mean, it's effectively under an attack, you know, by its regular users all day long anyway.
Their motivation, I would assume, is money.
By and large, yeah.
Perhaps maybe just taking control of the world too. Maybe some kind of.
I don't think they're that nefarious. Although it's clear that some of these botnets are operated by intelligence agencies. It appears that the Russian government has a substantial botnet and deployed it when they attacked. They had a cyber attack, I believe it was Estonia, and then again when they invaded Georgia, they had a variety of cyber attacks there, and a lot of them were designed to take down websites helping out with critical infrastructure, even stuff as seemingly benign as a private company that sold generators. They would take those sites down as well. Just because they were worried that people would be able to go out and buy a generator, you know, when the power went off. They wouldn't say that they have control of these botnets, but it's pretty clear that they do. And I would say it's also likely that the U.S. government probably has control of some botnets as well. In fact, there was a recent incident, fairly high profile, with Iran. So the Iranians' nuclear power infrastructure was attacked by a worm called Stuxnet, and it took most of their infrastructure offline for months. And it's pretty clear at this point that really only two countries in the world have the level of technical sophistication to develop a worm like this. And that's basically just the U.S. and Israel. And, of course, neither of them will admit that they did it. But the level of sophistication in the design of Stuxnet implies that some sort of state actor was involved in its creation. It leapfrogged through, I think, seven levels of indirection to finally find its way into the Iranian nuclear power infrastructure. And then once it was there, instead of just taking down the whole system all at once, it was designed to cause intermittent failures. So they would send the centrifuges trying to create the enriched uranium, you're spinning too slow or too fast, which disrupts the process and slowly degrades the centrifuges over time. So that not only was their uranium not getting enriched, and they couldn't tell why, it was also steadily degrading all of their centrifuges simultaneously. So it's clear now that this may have set the program back at least several months, but possibly a year or more.
It seems hard to believe that a country's nuclear power plant's computers could be so vulnerable. But the strategies to infiltrate the system are easier than one might think. It's kind of like spreading any disease, a simple matter of making contact.
As people have been unraveling Stuxnet, it's clear that perhaps most of the critical infrastructure was offline. But the way Stuxnet propagated, again, it had this sort of like seven layers of how it propagated. One layer involved putting itself on USB chips. So if somebody's home computer gets infected and they plug in a USB drive, it infects the USB drive. They take that USB drive into work, they plug it into this secure system in a nuclear power plant, and then it gets itself onto the nuclear power plant secure network. And this exact same tactic was actually used against the U.S. Back in 2008. So back in 2008, people dropped infected thumb drives in the parking lot for U.S. Central Command, just waiting for somebody to plug it in, and someone did. And once they did that, somebody had access to all the data going through Central Command for the period of about 2 months. And we still don't know who it was. But whoever had that access could see everything we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan for about 2 months.
It reminds me of smallpox. Like giving the Indians blankets with smallpox on it or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of analogies, I guess, between viruses and computer security. Just drop these infected USB sticks in and somebody's going to pick it up and plug it in.
How in the dark is the general American, do you think?
I'd say blissfully unaware of almost everything that's going on. To me, I thought this Stuxnet stuff was pretty high profile. We got a lot of media coverage, but still the average American has never heard of it. And this is, and really, it's the first shot in what could be a permanent cyber war between the U.S. and its enemies. I think this stuff could just go on indefinitely from this point. And it's not clear, what the rules of engagement are, how far you can go with escalation. Would we ever respond with physical force to a cyber attack? It's kind of a murky area.
Can you imagine a cyber war? And for listeners, explain what that really means.
It's difficult to imagine what a cyber war would include. There's so many dimensions you could attack. There's efforts to create this smart power grid here in the United States, where we're going to have a chip on every meter, helping to manage the power in the grid. Well, I'm going to guess that the software being deployed on those chips is probably going to be as insecure as all the other software we write. And so you could imagine an attack that would propagate itself through our power networks and, you know, literally shut down the power grid for the whole United States. You know, stuff like that is conceivable. Or you could imagine financial attacks. You could imagine somebody writing one of these malicious thumb drives and dropping it off in, you know, Wall Street parking lots and then having it wipe out all of the information about our financial records. I mean, if we just lost track of all our financial records, that could be devastating, just losing that information alone. There's a variety of dimensions it can take, whether it's a financial attack or an attack on our physical infrastructure. As more and more infrastructure becomes wired, you know, more and more becomes vulnerable.
And Matt Might is no stranger to how to attack a computer system. The reason he can understand and track these cyber criminals is that he once was one, starting at a very young age when he got his first computer in about 1989.
I've always been broadly interested in computers. My dad put a computer in my room when I think it was third grade. So this is pretty early on. And it was just, you know, it was an old DOS computer, so it didn't have any sort of windowing system. And all you could do was type in commands, and it would just spit stuff back. And, I mean, he didn't think anything of it. He just put it in my room thinking, oh, well, maybe he'll play with it. And, you know, one day I walked into my room, and I turned it on, and I typed in help, because I'd seen my dad type in help. And help brought up this list of commands that you could type in. So I said, okay, well, what does this command do? And so I just started playing around with each command one by one until I developed a sense of how to use this machine. And that's really how I got my start. Spent most of my childhood on a computer after that point. And I think my involvement with information security on the other side goes back to 7th and 8th grade. So when I was in 7th and 8th grade, the internet, this is I guess 94, 95, the internet was just getting big. Not even getting big, it was just really becoming available to end users through things like, you know, there was a gateway through Prodigy to get onto it, there was a gateway through AOL to get onto it, and I was fascinated by it. Now the problem with the internet back in those days was it was really expensive. Like maybe you remember that AOL would send out CDs and you could get like 5 free hours. Or, you know, you'd log on, you pay like $20 for literally 5 hours of access a month. I mean, 5 hours is nothing. I mean, that's an afternoon. And so, you know, I got my parents to sign me up for one of these things, and I think they got like a $2,000 bill from AOL because I'd spent so much time online. And they said, you know, I don't think we can afford this anymore. But I was like, you know, I lived online. I couldn't give it up. I did whatever it took to stay online, which was I started stealing credit card numbers. So... I actually started creating software programs that would allow me to do what they call phishing attacks en masse to try to figure out what people's credit card numbers were online. And after a while, I realized that was actually too labor intensive. And I realized that there's an algorithm behind valid credit card number generation. Once I figured out what that algorithm was, I was able to generate seemingly valid credit card numbers. You know, they'd cancel your account after a week when they figure out it was fake. But that's about how long it took back then. So, yeah, I'd generate one of these numbers, and I'd have an account for a week, and I could be online.
And did your parents wonder why you were successfully online?
You know, I don't think they really figured it out. All they know is that they weren't paying as much anymore. Yeah, so... That's how I stayed online. What's amazing is the algorithm for generating credit card numbers is available inside a U.S. patent from 1960. It's publicly available knowledge. And so if you go look up the patent, you could figure out how to generate these numbers in a valid fashion. Now, nowadays, people actually check credit card numbers in real time, but back in 1994, 95, they didn't actually do that.
And so what kind of math classes were you in at the time to be able to write these algorithms at such a young age? How old were you when you were writing these?
Oh, I was 13 years old, I think. I was a little bit advanced in math. Actually, my story with math is a little interesting. So between 7th and 8th grade, my mom put me in a high school algebra class over the summer, and I did very well in that. And then in 8th grade, I was back to doing like arithmetic, and I almost failed because I was so bored, which is ironic because at the same time, my mom was also putting me in these extra math classes run through ASU, the university down in Phoenix. So, you know, I was failing arithmetic, but then going off and doing, you know, advanced algebra in the afternoon after school. You know, because I was just so bored with school at that point. Mm. In fact, I was so bored with every subject, I think I almost failed out of grade school.
Other than credit card, were you mischievous in any other way, or was it directed mischievousness?
I was actually all about mechanizing mischief in some sense. Not only was I you know, doing things like generating credit card numbers and you know, programs for farming out, you know, the theft of these numbers, I was deploying these programs and giving them away for free so that other people could do it too. I don't know if that made me a good person or a bad person, but I was giving away all my tools for free. And I had other programs that would help you knock people offline. So if you had a problem with somebody, you could take their account offline. I mean, I developed all sorts of stuff and just released it. I was also stealing huge amounts of pirated software, you know, back before that was an easy thing to do. Because, you know, software was also expensive. And if you needed software, you more or less had to steal it. So
What
stopped me? Well, so I had a friend back in eighth grade who was doing a lot of stuff with me. And he released my real name and home address online. And that brought it to a stop pretty quick. That was a pretty pivotal moment in my childhood because we were getting these weird calls. People say, like, you know, we know who you are, we know what you're doing, you know, you need to stop, or, you know, we're going to come get you. I mean, all kinds of people were calling. It was just very, very freaky. My parents said, okay, I think we understand how you've been staying online now, so let's stop this. So it pretty much stopped right then and there in eighth grade.
Matt Mike currently uses a Mac laptop for day-to-day computing and programming. He rents a virtual machine in Dallas, Texas to run his Linux for his website, MiteNet. He has an old machine running Linux in his lab for all of his students. He has a Mac Mini connected to his TV. He rents a server in Phoenix, Arizona to run Linux for Yaplet.com, his online chat company. And he writes personal apps for his iPhone, which he uses almost as much as his laptop. And when it comes to security, he sticks to the three P's, passwords, patches, and protection, especially for PC users.
Basically, every operating system these days has some sort of patch system, if only for fixing the bugs they find in the software on that system. In terms of security, PCs are definitely the overwhelming target, and that's because from a criminal's perspective, you know, they're trying to make money. You have to keep that in mind. And if you write software to attack Macs, you're going to build a botnet the tenth the size of what you could build if you attack PCs. So for the same amount of effort, you get 10 times as many computers if you attack PCs over Macs. Now, there are other steps that companies like Apple and other operating systems like Linux will take to make them more secure, I'd say on average, than Windows, but they're certainly not invulnerable. I mean, you can attack a Mac just like, you know, you can attack a PC. It's just a little bit harder. But in Windows defense, I should say it's probably substantially harder to attack Windows today than it was 5 or 10 years ago, although it's still pretty easy in some sense.
And this 29-year-old computer whiz is working with all his might towards a secure future for all of us.
So in human terms, I want to go to my aunt's house and not have her say, you know, can you fix my computer because there's 10,000 viruses on it. That's a future I'd like to live in. And I think we can do that within 10 years. And I think software that doesn't crash and always does what you expect, I think that's realistic within 20 years. That's the world I'd like to live in, and that's the world I'm working to make happen.
Today, NASA is planning to launch the final mission of the Endeavour space shuttle. The onboard crew of 6 astronauts will deliver equipment and spare parts to the International Space Station. NASA's space shuttle fleet first launched on April 12, 1981. Starting with Columbia and continuing with Challenger, Discovery, Atlantis, and lastly Endeavour. The reusable spacecraft has launched, recovered, and repaired satellites, conducted research, and built the largest structure in space, the International Space Station. Soon after the launch, Jeffrey Notkin, co-host of the Science Channel's Meteorite Men, will present a donation of meteorites to the Challenger Space Center of Arizona. Notkin spoke with SQ Radio this spring outside of his booth at the International Gem Fair in Tucson. His passion for outer space and meteorites was obvious and infectious. He saw his first meteorite in the back of the Geological Museum in London when he was a young boy.
I remember as a 6 or 7 year old boy just putting my hands on these giant iron meteorites, and they felt so cold and strange and ominous, even slightly frightening. And I was mesmerized by the fact that they were not only beautiful in appearance, but they were literally aliens. They were visitors from outer space. I was already a rock hound. I spent most of my childhood in the quarries of southern England looking for fossils. And then in the evenings, I'd be stargazing with my dad through the telescope. So here are meteorites. And to me, they were the joining of astronomy and geology. They're rocks from other worlds. So it was all over for me from an early age. I never found anything in my life that was as interesting and fascinating as meteorites. And when I was that age, it was the late 60s, and there was no community of meteorite collectors then. All known meteorites, practically all of them, were in museum collections and university research departments. But I promised myself that one day I would actually own a space rock, somehow. Never did I imagine that it would eventually become not only my career, but my passion, and then I would then be co-hosting a television documentary series about meteorites. So I suppose it's a good example of how dreaming big sometimes pays off.
And what exactly is a meteorite compared to a meteor and a meteoroid?
There are three terms that we should define. A meteor is specifically the atmospheric phenomenon that's caused when a piece of cosmic debris flies through the atmosphere. And atmospheric pressure and friction generate heat, and the air incandesces around an incoming body. So that's a meteor. Shooting star, it's the same thing. A meteoroid is something that will become a meteor. In other words, part of an asteroid, space junk, that is in space approaching the Earth. And then the last step is the meteorite. So any piece of extraterrestrial material that lands on our planet is the meteorite. So it's meteoroid, meteor, and meteorite. And if you think about it, all meteorites caused a meteor as they flew through the atmosphere. But not all meteors produce meteorites, because some of them burn up completely.
And how rare are they? Because I read, I think in Chris Coquino's introduction, that there's 8 in every square mile. You can find 8 meteorites
per year.
There is an interesting statistic that 8 to 10 meteorites are thought to fall on each square mile of the surface of our planet every year. But they're tiny. Meteorites do fall all the time, but most of them are very, very small. Smaller than a pea, probably smaller than a pinhead, dust-sized particles. And so there's an interesting phenomenon in play here, which is the mass of our planet is actually growing as cosmic material lands. But new recoverable meteorites, in other words, a piece that's large enough to see and find, are very rare. There might be 3, 4, or 5 meteorite producing events each year worldwide that are witnessed. And I'm sure there are many more. If you think about it for a bit, you'll realize that statistically most meteorites fall in the ocean. And some will fall in the ice caps and in rainforests, and we'll never find them because they're not recoverable, and probably nobody witnessed them. If you ever go out in the desert late at night where it's very, very dark in the clear skies and lie on your back or in a deck chair and look up for a while, you'll see shooting stars. It doesn't have to be during the annual meteor showers like the Perseids and the Leonids. There's a lot of activity going on up there all the time. Our planet is constantly encountering little pieces of cosmic debris, but it's only a tiny percentage of them that survive their journey through the atmosphere, land in a place where we might find them, and are witnessed so that we even have an idea of where to start looking.
That was Jeffrey Notkin, co-host of the television series Meteorite Men. Notkin will be attending the Endeavour final liftoff celebration today in Peoria, Arizona. We wish the Endeavour crew a safe and successful launch and look forward to a new era of spaceflight vehicles. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. For more information, visit sqradio.org. You know it looks so good tonight.